For this presentation, we're moving to a new section of the Old Testament. We've been doing history. We've seen the people of Abraham coming into the land, taking it over, semi-taking it over, setting up their kingdom, seeing the kingdoms, seeing the kingdom under David and then Solomon rise, become very successful, and then collapse. And we saw Assyria in 722 BC. Taking over the 10 northern tribes, hauling them off to who knows where, they just disappear from history. And then in 586 BC, with the kingship of Zedekiah, he backed the wrong horse in a rebellion and ended up suffering the consequences when Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia came in and wiped out the southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, and took them off, some of them off into captivity. Totally ruined the city of Jerusalem, tore it apart, tore the temple apart, this temple that had been such a beautiful sight and such a wonderful place for the Jews to go to. It's gone. All the pieces of it are gone. Nobody knows where the Ark of the Covenant's disappeared. So we're done with the history section of the Old Testament. Now we're moving to a different kind, wisdom literature, different section of the Bible. And we'll take a look at Job, Ecclesiastes, and Proverbs, and things like that. So the big question, of course, as you probably already know, if you know anything at all about the book of Job, is the key question, why is there suffering? That's been an age-old question people have asked as long as they've been around. How should we conduct ourselves when we're facing terrible times? Job is what's called speculative wisdom, meaning it attacks the assumptions of society. So it takes on the usual ways of thinking about things. Somebody once called Job the first Protestant, and that's an interesting thought. Why? Because he stands on individual faith, not pious dogma. So he's going to hear a lot of pious dogma, but he's going to stick to his own individual faith throughout. So I thought that was an interesting way to approach it. Here's another way to think about it. There was a man named William Safire. He was actually a political consultant, but he had a book called The First Dissident. And in this book, he has a section here. He says, if the book of Job reaches across 2.5 millennia to teach anything to men and women who consider themselves normal, decent human beings, it's this. Human beings are sure to wander in ignorance and to fall into error, and it's better, more righteous in the eyes of God, for them to react by questioning rather than accepting. Confronted with inexplicable injustice, it's better to be irate than resigned. And then Safire says later on about the book of Job, I started my journey into this book with doubt in my faith and have come out with faith in my doubt. So the book has some power, and it has some power still today. So let's take a look at it. A lot of people think it's a story of patience. Have you ever heard that expression, the patience of Job? It's become a cliche. But I find it really ironic, and I'm sure you will too, when we've gone through the book, to realize patience doesn't describe Job. So let's do something which is going to sound a little odd, but as we start this book and begin to look at it, remember we're still in the Old Testament, but I'd like you to turn to the book of Luke, which is in the New Testament, one of the four Gospels telling the life of Jesus. And there's a story in the book of Luke 13, chapter 13, in which Jesus is with his disciples. And it says, there were some present, I'm starting verse 1, Luke 13, 1. Now there were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. So you recognize that name, Pilate. Eventually, Pilate is recalled to Rome. We learn this from extra-biblical literature, for his brutalities and bloodshed. So apparently this is just one episode where he's killed several Jews who were sacrificing to God. So Jesus takes that background, that newsworthy background. He says, do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? Now, why does he ask that question? Because that is what they thought. And frankly, I've heard too many horror stories down to today, one of them in my own family. And somebody just told me one the other day where people have suffered and somebody comes alongside them and says exactly this. Oh, you've suffered or this person has suffered because there's something bad going on in your life, right? Some kind of secret sin. What's Jesus' response? I tell you, is it true that they were sinners, more terrible sinners than the others who have lived? I tell you, no. And Jesus continues, verse 4, and he has another news item for him. He says, how about those 18 who died when the tower in Siloam fell on them? Do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? So apparently there was this accident, and 18 people died when a tower collapsed and crushed them. Again, I'm sure tongues wagged and said, well, God must have had some big reason to take those out. And Jesus says, no, they were not more guilty. Now, if that was just isolated to just a few verses in Luke, we might think, oh, well, that's all there is to it, that Jesus didn't really spend much time on that. But if you turn to the book of John, I want to show you something there. This is John 9, chapter 9. And in John 9, we're going to encounter something pretty much like this, the first verse of John 9. Jesus is going along, says he went along, he saw a man blind from his birth. So his disciples see this, and they ask him a question. They've got it all figured out. So they say, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now, they've got it all understood, right? They know that it's sin. It's just a question of, gee, do you think this guy screwed up, or was it his parents? And what's Jesus' response? Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. And then he heals this man. But isn't that interesting? Two different Gospels, two different accounts, two different situations. In both cases, Jesus says, let's get something straight. It was not sin that caused the problems in these people's lives. And Job is a perfectly good account of that. So we're going to look at the book of Job now. If you can flip back to Job in the Old Testament. And notice the structure of this, for one thing. It starts off, do you recognize chapter 1? It looks like prose, doesn't it? And then what happens in chapter 3? Well, there it goes. We're on our way to poetry, and we get poetry, and we get poetry, and we get poetry clear until the very end of the book. And then the last, let's see, how many? The epilogue. Chapter 42 starts verse 7, continues to 17, so the last 10 verses. So it's got a nice balanced structure here from prose to poetry. The majority of it is poetry, and back to prose again. One thing I find interesting is just the dating of the book of Job. If you notice at the beginning, it doesn't sound like he's Jewish. We don't know. Just there was this man. We don't even know where the land of Uz was. I didn't mean to make that a poem. And it just says his name is Job. He feared God. He had 7 sons, 3 daughters, had all sorts of animals. Greatest man among all the people of the East. Kind of vague, huh? And it says Job, if you look in verse 5, early in the morning he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of his children. Now, is this a Jewish thing? I don't know. It just says it was his custom. So we're really not sure. Some people think this may be one of the most ancient books in the Old Testament. Are you beginning to catch on, by the way, that the books of the Old Testament are not laid out chronologically? Do you notice that? The first 5 books appear to have some sort of chronological order, and so do some of the books describing the rise of David. But here's Job, probably much more ancient than the book of 1st or 2nd Samuel. And we'll see that repeated throughout the Old Testament. All right, so let's get into the story itself of Job. There's apparently some odd cosmic bet going on. Isn't that an unreal situation at the beginning? It says the angels, verse 6, chapter 1, came to present themselves before the Lord. What is that? I don't know. The Bible doesn't really tell us. And Satan, the word meaning accuser, comes with them. So when is this? What's going on? I don't know. It's like a court, isn't it? And these are the court officials, in a sense, coming before him. And it's almost like God... Oh, how do I say this? It's like God has set up Satan and nudges him, in a sense, psychologically works on him to come up with some bet, because he brings forth the idea of Job in verse 8. Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Well, that was just egging Satan on. And so Satan sneers and says, well, of course he's good. He's got a lot of stuff going for him. You know, the old idea that, are you blessed by God? Look around. If you are, then God likes you. We saw some of that actually when the Pilgrims and the Puritans came over to this country, because they believed that God picked them for salvation, that they didn't pick God. So they call that predestination. And so that was a little confusing to them, because if they couldn't look at a calendar and say, well, you know, that's the day that I went forward at a big crusade and turned my life over to God, they can't do that. They just say, well, things seem to be working out in my life. I must be one of the elect. Well, how do they know things are working out? Well, how's their book store doing? How are their crops doing? How's the marriage doing? How many kids are they having? Animals and things like that. So we see something a little bit like that here. Satan says, hey, Job's doing fine. No wonder he's worshiping you. And so God basically says he's not going to give in. He's going to maintain his right standing with me. And Satan says, want to bet? So we get this cosmic bet. And the end of chapter 1, Job did not sin. While all sorts of devastation, destruction was taken from him. And then in verse 2, chapter 2, Job himself is actually attacked here. And Satan afflicts Job with sores. He's just sitting in the ash heap. And chapter 2, verse 9, his wife. Now, this this bothers me in a way, because I have a very supportive wife. And here she comes alongside of Job. Does she support him? Does she tell him, hang in there, Job, I'm with you, I trust you, you're a good man? These are the words. Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. So not exactly the kind of help. So she's still alive, but she's not going to be a bundle of help. Then he has three friends that come and join him. And the rest of the book, we're going to see the friends actually don't do anything very helpful. In fact, we'll see some problems with what they say to Job. But before we get to the negatives, I want you to think about something very wonderful with these three friends. It says, they all set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. I said they could hardly recognize him. And then in verse 13 of chapter 2, they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. Is that a great witness? Is that a great testimony to the joy of friendship, the positive values of friendship? Somebody comes alongside somebody else who's deep in suffering, and instead of a quick solution or a pat on the back or a greeting card or a whatever it is, just, hey, I'll think about you, they actually sit there and they don't offer some kind of cheap advice. They sit there with him for 7 days and 7 nights. They don't say a word. They just share. That's tremendous empathy, isn't it? And then I'd like you to see, especially the next few chapters, to see a sequence of what happens here. First, Job speaks. And he's not patient. He's so depressed. Verse 3 of chapter 3, may the day of my birth perish. And the night it was said a boy is born, that day may it turn to darkness. And he talks about death. In verse 20, why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter of soul? To those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave. Mark Twain said something like that at first. He said, people celebrate at the birth of a child and sorrow at the death of an old person. He said it should be the other way around. So there's Mark Twain, quite a cynic. And Job sounds a lot like that, doesn't it? Doesn't he? But now, the 7 days have gone by. Here's where the friends start sticking their feet in their mouths. And remember the ones that were walking with Jesus and say, who sinned, the man or his mother, the blind person? We're going to get something like that. We're going to see a cycle here, and I want to walk you through how this cycle works. First friend, Eliphaz, chapter 4. and look just one place, verse 7. Consider, he says to Job, who, being innocent, has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? So he says, look around you, Job. The evil people always get theirs. God's keeping track. And verse 8 of chapter 5. But if it were I, I would appeal to God. I would lay my cause before him. Verse 17, blessed is the man whom God corrects. That's why he thinks this is going on. There's some correcting. God's taking him to the woodshed. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. So that's pretty cheap advice, isn't it? You're suffering on purpose. It's God's way to bring you around, so don't despise it. But of course, Job responds not with patience. Chapter 6. Verse 15, my brothers are as undependable as intermittent streams, as the streams that overflow when darkened by thawing ice and swollen with melting snow. Verse 21, you too have proved to be of no help. 24, teach me, and I'll be quiet. Show me where I've been wrong. Verse 30, is there any wickedness on my lips? Into chapter 7, verse 11. I will speak out in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. So he says, I'm not sitting here and taking this. I'm upset. I'm angry. I will complain. Well, that was friend one, chapter 8, Bildad. This is his second friend. Similar thing. Look at verse 6. If you're pure and upright, even now he will rouse himself in your behalf and restore you to your rightful place. So get your act together, Job, is what he says. Straighten up. Get your spiritual life in order. That's your problem. And once you figure it out and confess and all that, then God will work it out for you. And Job replies, verse 21, chapter 9, verse 21, although I am blameless, I have no concern for myself, I despise my own life. Verse 28, I know you will not hold me innocent, since I'm already found guilty. Why should I struggle in vain? You already decided I'm guilty. Verse 32, he is not a man like me that I might answer him, that we could confront each other in court. If only there were someone to arbitrate between us, to lay his hand upon us both. So Job feels this tremendous gap between him and God, and he's so frustrated. If there's just somebody that in a sense could bring the two of them together, to bring God and bring Job together, Job, the suffering one, God, the one who sees over all. And he just feels so frustrated at this point. Well, that was friend number two. Let's go to chapter 11. Zophar, friend number three. Well, let's see how, does he say the same thing or does he try to approach Job differently? Well, you decide. Verse 4 of chapter 11. You say to God, my beliefs are flawless and I am pure in your sight. Oh, how I wish that God would speak, that he would open his lips against you and disclose to you the secrets of wisdom. For true wisdom has two sides. Know this, God has even forgotten some of your sin. Oh, here we go again, huh? Verse 14, if you put away the sin that's in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, you will stand firm and without fear. So it's the same story, right? This is Act 3. This is the same take 3, right? So three friends have all said it's your fault, and Job is replying, trying to defend himself. And one of my favorite verses in all of this book is chapter 12, verse 2. Job replies, doubtless you are the people and wisdom will die with you. How's that for sarcasm? He doesn't believe that at all. And he says, once again, I am innocent. Let me pick up here and show you what happens again. And let me continue. Verse 15, here comes the second, or sorry, chapter 15, here comes the second cycle. Remember we had Eliphaz first, and then Zophar, and then the third one, Bildad? I think Zophar is third, sorry. We're going to get the same thing in chapter 15. Here comes Eliphaz. He says, again, your fault, Job. Chapter 16, Job's response. 18 is Bildad, chapter 18, second friend. His comments, Job's response, that same ping-pong kind of affair back and forth. And then Zophar in chapter 20, and it happens again, another cycle in 22, 23, 24, 25. And it continues on. We won't take the time to do that. Some great poetry in here. Then another friend shows up, Elihu. And Elihu, you'd think, okay, we've had three people just pounding on Job. Maybe this guy's got a better approach. Well, look in chapter 34, verse 10. So listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do evil, from the Almighty to do wrong. He repays a man for what he has done. He brings upon him what his conduct deserves. Oh, great. Here we go again. Verse 11 is just the replay, isn't it? He repays a man for what he has done. Everything that happens to you is because you have done right or you have done wrong. He brings upon him what his conduct deserves. He and these other friends want this nice, neat world of cause and effect. You have a problem, you brought it on yourself. We don't want to think about things being inscrutable, things being beyond our understanding. Let's just say that it was your fault. Okay, well, with that, I'd like to pick up at chapter 38. Now, out of the storm, after all of this talking, all of this blame laying, all of this complaining by Job and trying to defend himself, all of a sudden, something big happens here. Chapter 38, verse 1, then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. Oh, okay. Well, we've been waiting and we've been waiting and we've been waiting. That sense of suspense, all of this talk. Now, the main character comes on the stage. And what does he do? His first words are not, gosh, I'm sorry you don't understand, Job. Let me explain. Instead, verse 3, brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. Oh, wait a minute. I thought Job was questioning God and God was supposed to show up and give him an answer. Apparently not. In the first question, what do you think Job's answer is to this? Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Oh, well, I guess I wasn't around. You can pick any of these questions out of here. How about 18? Verse 18, have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Verse 21, here's God's sarcasm. Surely you know, for you are already born. You've lived so many years. Verse 31, I like astronomy. Look at this. Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? The Pleiades are a small star cluster that you can see in the sky tight together, sometimes called the Seven Sisters. It's actually the symbol that a Subaru uses for its cars. If you have a small telescope, by the way, focus in on the Pleiades. They are beautiful. They have wisps of material between the stars, dust and gas that glows. It's just beautiful. The second half of verse 31 in chapter 38. Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you scatter Orion? Of course, you've probably seen Orion, one of the most famous constellations in the sky. So God's asking some very difficult questions, which Job, of course, has no knowledge, no answer for. How about chapter 40? God says to him at the beginning, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. Well, so what does Job have to say? Is he ready to bring forth his complaints? Chapter 40, verse 4, I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more. And so he basically says, you got me. Well, I mean, what can I say to God? And he, if that's okay, I'm going to go ahead here. God speaks again and talks about the behemoth in verse 15. Some people think that's the elephant. Chapter 41 talks about Leviathan. Thomas Hobbes used that title in a famous book of his, Philosopher. So there's Leviathan. So God's in charge of all these things. Chapter 42, Job replies again, and he's totally submitted. He says in verse 3, surely I spoke of things I did not understand. And then verse 4, I'm sorry, let's go to verse 5. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now Job never says I sinned, but he just basically says, I spoke too rashly. I acted as if I understood God. There's no way. I don't understand God. He's got some kind of new knowledge, doesn't he? My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Now, he's not talking about physically seeing God, but he's seeing God with some sight that he didn't have before. Well, that essentially wraps it up with this exception. At the end, things are given back to Job. if you look in verse, last chapter 42, look at verse 12. Lord gives him more than he had at first. In fact, he doubles everything except, and this is a part that some people find intriguing. He doubles the sheep. He doubles the camels that had been taken away from him at the beginning of the story. He doubles the oxen. He doubles the donkeys. Now, when you go to verse 13, he does not double the sons and daughters. He gives them back the same amount. And some people find that odd. Why would he double everything else, but he doesn't give them double the children? Now, here's what some people have said. Let's see if you think this makes sense or not. Job will not see his animals again. They're done. So when they die, that's it. But the seven sons and three daughters that he had that died, he may see them again if there is an afterlife. And so he gets seven sons and three daughters now. He had seven sons and three daughters before. He still has them. They're just in a different world. So in a sense, they have been doubled as well. So there you go, the book of Job. Does it answer anything? Well, not really. It's one of the most ironic stories, almost a bitter irony, where Job is thinking about things. His friends offer all sorts of suggestions. The story comes to an end, and Job basically is shut up at the end. He's ignorant. And the whole point of this wisdom literature is ignorance. Seems odd. But it basically says, you're God, I'm not. That much I understand. Anything else I don't really get. Has this book had some power? Oh, yes. Herman Melville, Thomas Hobbes. There have been other authors that have used it because of its agony and because of its lack of a clear answer. Modern people, in a sense, like that because they don't think they have clear answers to anything. So there's still some power to this book. Okay, well, next time we're finishing up this part of wisdom literature, I'd like to look at Proverbs, maybe Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. We'll try to do those both as well. That's also considered a section of wisdom literature.